You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of CROI 2010, the 17th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections. The conference took place in San Francisco, California, from February 16th through February 19th, 2010.
Thank you all for coming. This session is a review of the oral abstract session 23, HIV Vaccines Path Forward. I'm Richard Kaup. I think we could call this session a tale of two vaccines. I think, as you are all aware, over the last 5 years, there have been two major vaccine products that have been tested in efficacy trials. Approximately 2 years ago, one of those vaccine trials was stopped due to lack of efficacy. That was the two trials of the Merck Ad5 vaccine, which was a pure T-cell based vaccine and was supposed to limit viral load in those who became infected. More recently, just last fall, we completed a trial in Thailand of RV144, which was a vaccine with two components, a LVAC vector followed by a GP120 boost. That vaccine actually showed partial efficacy, about 31% protection against infection. I think moving forward, figuring out why one vaccine failed and why the other vaccine succeeded are a very important basic scientific question that needs to be addressed in the very near future. And I think that today we heard the beginnings of results of the analyses of those trials that start to address why one vaccine may have protected and one vaccine may have failed. We heard from Nelson Michael that there was good antibody responses in the RV144 trial and that efficacy looked to be stronger early than late, and that the antibody responses dropped concomitant with the potential loss of efficacy, although those results did not reach statistical significance. And we heard from Morgan Roland that looking at the T-cell responses in the STEP trial, that there is evidence that there was an impact on either the transmitted virus or the evolution of that virus after infection that was induced by the Merck vaccine. So what I'd like to do now is turn the microphones over for brief statements by both of the investigators, and then we'll open it up for questions. So we'll start with Nelson.
Thanks, Rick. Actually, you gave a very nice summary of the results that we presented. I guess I would only add one additional comment about the data that we did just speak about a few minutes ago, which is that in Paris and in our publication in the New England Journal of Medicine, we described that in this low-incident population, largely of people at heterosexual risk for HIV infection in Thailand, we looked at baseline risk and identified individuals that were at relatively higher or lower risk for HIV infection. And that analysis did not achieve statistical significance in terms of what your risk category was and whether or not there was a difference in the protective efficacy, even though the numbers looked like they were headed in that direction. In the individuals that had the highest incidence, the estimate of efficacy was 3%. Versus 31%, but the confidence intervals were very, very large. What I presented today is that when we look at individuals at every six-month time point when they came in and said, put individuals in two categories, those that never described a higher risk behavior and those that, even if they described a single episode of having a higher risk category, they would be in a different bin. So if you compare those two groups, the individuals that described at any point in the study a higher risk, those individuals had a lower, there was a lower efficacy in that group, and that p-value was 0.008. So the caveats to that is that is a post hoc analysis, and in a clinical study, anything that you dream up to study after the data are unblinded, which you should take with a grain of salt, a pretty big one, because the chance that those kinds of associations are influenced by statistical variation go up. So even though a p-value of that magnitude is one that should still be interpreted with caution. And secondly, that doesn't indicate necessarily that this vaccine would not have worked in individuals of in a higher incidence population, because it's possible that the what we think is an early and non-durable effect of this vaccine, that may be confused with the fact that in the higher risk individuals, they may have simply been having risk exposures outside of a protective window that occurred in the first part of the study. So it's an exploratory observation, but it's one that we think is going to be important as the debate goes forward as to what we do next, not only with these products, but what we do next with other products in terms of next generation efficacy studies. Thank you. So there are discussions in the field as to whether or not we should be doing studies simply in very, very high incidence populations, especially those in sub-Saharan Africa. Essentially, go to where the epidemic is raging, do studies in parts of the world and in populations where you have very, very high transmission rates. And ultimately, if one was to deploy a globally effective vaccine, it would be logical that those would be the first groups that you would want to provide a public health benefit like a vaccine to. On the other hand, and the other part of the discussion is, if what you learn from RV144 is that this combination of vaccines worked in a Thai population at relatively low incidence and worked with a circulating type of the virus that you see in Thailand, should you perhaps use that as an extension, have at least one arm of any next study have those attributes with it? And so that's part of the debate and dialogue in the field right now, and as a consequence of what we're trying to learn from RV144, I'm trying not to come to the conclusion, because I don't think we can, that this vaccine would only have worked in a low incident population. So I think that even though our newer data may lead some people to believe that's what we're saying, in fact, because of other uncertainties about the duration of the benefit, I think that those two issues may be confused. So I think, as I look at these data, I think that it provides a rationale for us to have equipoise on that question. And I think that my own personal bias would be, I think it makes sense for us to test next generation vaccines or even this combination again, but probably in a study design where you have two arms, a relatively higher incidence and a relatively lower incident heterosexual population. I think that would be a reasonable accommodation of what we actually know and what we can infer from the data.
So what we did is looking at the HIV sequences from individuals, volunteers in the STEP vaccine trial who became infected after receiving either the vaccine or the placebo. And we had sequences from 40 vaccinees and 28 placebo recipients. And when we compared those sequences, we found that the sequences from the vaccinees were genetically different from the one in the placebo when we did comparisons with the STEP vaccine sequence. So when we looked at, since this was a CTL-based vaccine, we looked specifically at CTL epitopes and measured distances between the CTL epitopes that we identified in the breakthrough viruses and compared those to the corresponding epitopes in the vaccine, the Merck vaccine insert. And when we compared those distances, the distances were larger among vaccinees than among placebo recipients. And so this shows that there are more mutations in sequences from vaccinees than in sequences from placebo recipient when you compare them to the vaccine insert. And we found that this signal was only seen in the vaccine, the proteins, in epitopes coming from the proteins that were included in the vaccine, so GAG, POL, and NEF. And when we compared the other proteins of the virus, there was no difference between vaccine and placebo recipient. So this suggests that either the vaccine blocked the outgrowth of specific HIV-1 variants that were the one that were the most similar to the vaccine insert sequence, or that the CTL induced by the vaccine, the CTL responses induced by the vaccine, led to further evolution or faster or more mutations in the sequences from the infected individuals. And those were sequences from the earliest time point in infection, so we are going to do further studies to see over time.
To ask Dr. Michael, I wasn't in the presentation, so I just wanted to make sure I got the overview right. The people who had some evidence of risk, if you just looked at them, then it was clear that the vaccine did not work. Was that it?
So, well, first let me point out that individuals that described continuous low risk were clearly having risky behavior. So I think that because we saw infections in individuals that described that they never had high-risk behaviors. That's the first point to capture. It is true that in individuals that at any point in the study said that they had a high-risk behavior, that if you looked at that category of individual, they were less likely to have a protective effect than individuals that always describe a lower risk lifestyle. And I think the critical point is that may very well be confounded by the fact that the vaccine appears to have had a transient effect, so that it may not imply that this vaccine would not have worked in higher incident populations. So really the key point is this: we can't confuse incidence, the rate of disease transmission, with risk. And I think that's part of the debate we're having right now with collectively as vaccine development groups as to what those results may really mean as we go up and design next studies. So I think that's just be careful with that interpretation. I think that risk and transmission and durability of vaccine effect may all be intertwined, and our ability to tease those out with this study, I think, is going to be extremely challenging. And I think it is likely going to require additional science and additional studies for us to deconvolute those points.
Yeah, this is for Dr. Michael. Are there new candidates for correlates of immunity that have emerged from this study that were not suspected before?
Well, that's a great question. I think the simple answer is we're just now, within the next 2 weeks, we're going to begin doing the wet work. We begin to answer. So the short answer to your question is I don't know yet. The longer answer will be probably about 1 year from now is when we'll be in a position to answer your question. And I described in the latter part of my talk how there's really been, I called it an all-hands-on-deck, because there's a very, very large number of individuals in the field, the majority of whom were not involved in the study. So we went out and are trying to collaborate with the best and brightest in the field writ large to ask precisely the questions that you have enumerated. Over the next 6 months, we'll be doing exploratory studies trying to understand which of the handful of potential assays we'll use in the ultimate, what we call a case control study design, that will be the true test of looking for a correlate. Those studies will initiate in the summer, and we should have all those data in by roughly the holiday period of 2010, and hope to be able to publicly discuss those data sometime early in 2011.
Just one more follow-up question on RV144. Did you do any work to tease out within the people who reported having any higher risk behavior, whether that was IDU versus just heterosexual risk?
So, as I described in our presentation, only a very small number of individuals had what we would consider traditional risk behaviors of that type. There are only two individuals that reported commercial sex work and another 12 individuals of same gender. We had no individuals at baseline that describe injection drug use. So the problem is that injection use of other, if you will, not using substance of abuse, if you actually ask, did you ever expose yourself to needles in any fashion, the answer is yes, there were some individuals that had behaviors that were not associated with, as an example, the use of something like heroin, but were behaviors like tattooing that could be associated with needle use. And what we tried to do, remember, this was not a part of the study that was powered to ask this question. We said, can we look at when individuals became infected during the period of time of the study and look at their proximate risk? Because every 6 months they're coming in, we're asking the risk behavior questions. And so can we say, aha, here's an individual that described risk and looks like there's a blip in infection? The answer is that we don't have the power to answer that question. So we really don't know. So yes, there were no individuals at baseline that had injection drug use behaviors, but there were sporadic instances of people being exposed to needles in other fashions, but I don't think we're going to be able to rationally come to an answer as to whether or not those other behaviors were associated with transmission. So just to reiterate, this was really a study of lower incident heterosexuals in Thailand. And so in that sense, this was a study not done in traditional high-risk groups like individuals that are commercial sex workers or same-gender sex.
A question for Dr. Rowland. Does your study at all address Ad5 seropositivity? Can you look at sequence to see anything? And is there any clarification at this point as to whether circumcision was the determining factor? Can you clarify it at all?
So our own study did not look at 5-seropositivity. At 5-seropositivity is not associated with the higher risk of infection in the largest data that Susan Buck-Bider has presented. The significance of the Ad5, the association with Ad5, it was only a 0.08 significance in the first study. And since a larger number of cases have been accumulating, this has dropped to, I don't know, you would have to check, but it's 0.2 now. So the significance with that 5-seropositivity is gone. And we did not see, since the effect that we are looking at is not, by looking at the genetic influence of the sequences, we are really not looking at acquisition, but more at what's happening afterwards, maybe with the HIV-1 sequences. But there was no difference in circumcision. We had same numbers in the placebo and vaccinees.
One more question. If there were to be a follow-up study with a low-incidence heterosexual population, where would be places that could be conducted?
So in our own network, we have sites in East Africa and in Thailand. We actually, it's curious, Dr. Rob, one of my colleagues, is sitting two people behind you, just next to John Cohen. And we actually did a study in just about an hour north of Kampala, Uganda, looking for a high-risk cohort, because all of us really have conceived that as the right place to work for every reason under the sun. That's where the epidemic is raging. That's where you can get answers quickly. That's where you can get answers efficiently in terms of cost. And so we went to Kayunga, and we did a formal incident study. So we enrolled several thousand individuals, had them come back every 6 months, you know, the old-fashioned way. And we were excited for the government of Uganda to tell them that the incidence in that population was quite low, 0.8, about five to tenfold lower than the data that you've seen from Glenda Gray presenting from heterosexual cohorts in the Republic of South Africa. But for our initial review of that data, we said that's disappointing for us as scientists because we probably can't work there in terms of efficiently doing vaccine studies. Now we're rethinking that. So it is possible, certainly, for you to go to what we call community risk populations all over Africa and not necessarily concentrate on the highest transmitting or the highest incident population. So besides cohorts in Southeast Asia, like Thailand, that we have identified, certainly those cohorts of a similar ilk exist in Africa. But there's a debate in the field right now about what really is the relative merit between taking what was an operational, it seems like to be an obvious operational step. What you learn in RV144, you change as few variables as possible. And one of those variables might be the level of transmission risk, relatively high versus relatively low. So it's critical to not think that you can only do studies of the type of RV144 only in a place like Thailand. You can do them elsewhere to include sub-Saharan Africa. You just have to choose with good epidemiology where you would do it.
The question for Dr. Michael. What's your budget for this year, and how much do you have to conduct the trial again? Do you have enough money to do it, or would you have to get funds from elsewhere?
So our budget is complex, so I can break it down pretty quickly. The U.S. Army provides my program roughly $30 million a year to do vaccine research. That's hardwired into the president's budget. Then we have a substantial portfolio of grants from the NIAID that runs roughly about another $20 million, but those are constrained to certain projects, so I don't have discretion in terms of taking those dollars and refocusing them on something else. And then a very, very large commitment from the State Department. We have a very large PEPFAR program, over 70,000 Africans under antiretroviral therapy in four countries in Africa, and that PEPFAR piece is roughly $70 million. Obviously, I can't touch those dollars as well. So the straight up answer to your question is the Army can probably bring roughly $8 million a year to any further study that we would ever do. And just to give you some context of what $8 million means, at the height, the most expensive year for RV-144 was $17 million. That was the most expensive year. So if you were to do a study that cost roughly that much, John, the Army could contribute roughly 50% of that. And so traditional funders like NIAID and the Gates and potentially others, we would need to look to. So, but that's a critical point, because what the audience should take back from that is MHRP is not only not willing, but also not able to, if you will, go rogue and do a next study by itself. We did RV-144 with approximately 75% of those funds came from NIAID. It was a powerful synergy to work in a collaborative way, and we would definitely not look to any follow-on study in any different philosophy. We would do it collaboratively.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
Thank you for listening to this report from CROI 2010. For more coverage of this conference, please visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2010.